This is Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Joining us today is Dorothy Golden Rosenberg, PhD. She will be sharing her expert knowledge with listeners on the subject of the health damaging effects of exposure to the normal releases of the normally operating nuclear power facility. Good morning, Dorothy.
Good morning.
Let's start off. Give the listeners just a brief accounting of your scientific background, your education, and your employment experience.
Well, I was initially trained as a physiotherapist many years ago, where I had a basic knowledge of science. But basically, I'm a social scientist, and I have been drawing from the best of the radiation biologists and other scientists over the years to develop the knowledge that I have, that many of us have, from these various wonderful scientists, such as Dr. Rosalie Bertel. These are all doctors or PhDs. Jeanette Sherman, Gordon Edwards, Walt Patterson, John Goffman, Alice Stewart, Stephen Wing, J.M. Gould. There are many of them who've been writing on these issues over the years. I also have been involved with many organizations where I have learned from many of these people in the context of conferences, papers, projects, and so on. So many of us are learned in ways that come from our experience. And I've often said that before I got my Master's in Environmental Studies at York University and my PhD at the University of Toronto, I had a wealth of knowledge from the work that I had done over many years.
Yes.
I have worked with Voice of Women for Peace. I came into Voice of Women for Peace learning about the Baby Tooth campaign, which was started in the United States by Barry Commoner, but which was done by Voice of Women, headed by Ursula Franklin in Canada. And that Baby Tooth campaign was during the time of nuclear weapons testing in the atmosphere, where baby's first teeth, as they fell out, were collected. And they were tested for strontium-90, which is a product of fallout from the nuclear weapons testing. And parents were very disturbed, as were scientists, to find out that indeed there was strontium-90 in the children's teeth. Now, strontium-90, it acts like calcium in our bodies, and it replaces the calcium in our teeth and in our bones. And we all know that we were told to drink milk because that would make our teeth and bones strong when we were children. So here they had example of the very product that was being displaced. Calcium was being displaced by the strontium-90, and it turned out that indeed there was much of it in those children's teeth, which meant that it was in their bodies as well, in their bones and in their bodies. It meant that it was in everybody's bones and bodies. And this led to the signing of the Partial Test Ban Treaty, and it only succeeded in getting nuclear weapons testing to go underground. And it didn't stop nuclear weapons testing altogether, which we know. And, of course, the testing continued underground for many years to come. But that's an example of how many, many people learned about radiation and health. That was a very first beginning for a lot of us. But then, as I moved along through my work here in Canada, in the 1970s, I was involved with Canada as a Conservative Society, which was a Canadian Science Council study, again, chaired by Dr. Ursula Franklin, who chaired the Baby Tooth campaign in Canada. She's a Quaker and a peacewoman and a geologist and a very well-known inspiration and mentor to many people in Canada. And the Canada as a Conservative Society was a program looking at where we would be in 50 years if we didn't want nuclear and coal and what we called the hard energy path. And Amory Lovins, whom many of your listeners will probably know of, was called upon to work with us to develop soft energy paths with scientists, with economists, with energy analysts, and do soft energy paths for all the different provinces in Canada. Now, looking ahead 50 years and where we wanted to be, and then working backwards, what could we put in place over those years was a very, very important experiment, because we realized that we could not do the work that had to be done if the billions of dollars were going to go into nuclear power and other destructive technologies. So it was a very big learning experience. And you can just imagine where we would be now if we had actually taken up the recommendations of the soft energy path back in the 70s. If we had done that, we would be way ahead towards that 50 years, because many years have gone by.
Exactly.
So we talk about the need for not putting the financial eggs in the nuclear basket and get ahead with the energy efficiency, conservation, renewables, and all the things that we know that we have to do. So these were my experiences in learning about all these issues. And then later in the 80s, when I was at the National Film Board, Challenge for Change, I was a researcher and a writer and an educator with film, and I was using film as a tool for social change. I was given a copy of a videotape of Dr. Helen Caldicott explaining the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. And I was so struck by it that I knew that we had to do something, and I knew that we had to get this brilliant spokesperson to come to Canada, which we did. I bicycled up to the hospital, to the Jewish General Hospital, to a friend, Michael Dworkin, Dr. Michael Dworkin, showed him the video, called me back 3 days later and said, "Dorothy, I haven't slept for three nights." Now, Michael Dworkin is the current president of Physicians for Global Survival here in Canada, but over all these years we have worked together. This little video of her explaining Three Mile Island and the health impacts of radiation, this little video led to organizing so that we invited Helen Caldicott to Montreal. She spoke at McGill University's Faculty of Medicine for doctors, and then she spoke at a general meeting. And at that time, we founded our chapter of what is now Physicians for Global Survival. It was then Physicians for Social Responsibility, very connected with a lot of the work that was going on in the United States. And then it became Canadian Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and now it's Physicians for Global Survival. Now, the name has changed, but basically the work has been on the links between nuclear weapons and nuclear technology, and how do we change all of this. And as probably many of your listeners know, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War received a Nobel Prize for Peace a number of years ago. So this is the kind of work that I did, learning from other scholars, learning from other scientists, working together in campaigns, and it really was learning by doing. Being at the National Film Board at that time, I brought that tape up to the film board and showed it to people in Studio D. Some of the people were very taken up with it, and Terry Nash and a group of us went on to make the film If You Love This Planet, which by many people who used it and saw it, it won the Academy Award, by the way, and it was one of the films that was banned by Ronald Reagan at the time. There were two others as well that were, but when Terry Nash held up the Academy Award, she said, "Thank you, Ronald Reagan," because by banning it, they people wanted to see it. It was like banning a book in Boston. Everybody wanted to read it.
Yeah, cool.
But that film really made a lot of ripples. I wrote a resource guide to go with it, full of information about the issues themselves, and also the what to do, how we change things, what do we know about nuclear weapons. And as you know, well, maybe you don't, maybe people don't remember what Helen Caldicott did so well in that film. What she did was she explained what happened during a nuclear bomb blast in the immediate vicinity, and then in the various areas around it. And it was very riveting and very dramatic. I believe that that film is still around. It is online through the National Film Board of Canada, and it's called If You Love This Planet, for people who might be interested in seeing that. But that was a riveting film, and people told me years and years later how that film changed their lives. So people are being educated all the time, even if they don't have the formal education of the Master's in Environmental Studies and the PhD. I just wanted to say that there are a lot of really good activists out there working away in their own communities relating to these issues, which are so serious, and learning as they do, learning as they go along.
Well, your path sounds a lot like my path. I totally honor this thing because it's truly what, you know, I'm honoring myself, you know, at the same time. this thing of learning from doing, and regardless of whether the credentials are there, being expert and a person with expert knowledge, because we read, we think, we act upon these things we learn about, and that builds a very strong expert knowledge. You have it, I have it, neither one of us are, you know, say, have a PhD in the particular field that we have.
Well, I have a PhD in how we're learning about these issues.
Exactly.
My PhD has to do with education and cancer prevention.
And
so all of these issues come together in a way that led to my academic degree. I will say, though, it is useful to have these degrees because when you get up and do a deputation at a hearing and you have a PhD, they look at you differently. You know, I'm still the same person I was for many, and I'm an old grandmother now. But, you know, they somehow these degrees resonate in some way. So it's useful to have some people with these degrees. But the majority of activists out there who are doing an excellent job don't have degrees, and you don't have to. You know, you speak from the heart, you speak from your passion, and you can change things.
Speaking from the heart, that is so powerful. Now, tell me, let's jump now into some of the more complex scientific matters here of the interview. What is your list, Jill? What list do you want to share with the listeners as to the pollutants that are released into our environment, our planet, by nuclear power facilities?
Right. Well, here in Ontario, and you in many places as well, where you have nuclear reactors, you have tritium, carbon-14, and other radionuclides, which are carcinogens, mutagens, and teratogens. That means it crosses the placental barrier and causes harm. And they are routinely emitted into the drinking water, air, soil, and hence food. So, and I'll come back to tritium a little bit later. We know that there's no safe dose. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, the World Health Organization, has many studies showing that carcinogens cause cancer. Recently, the National Academy of Sciences, a couple of years ago, produced a study, The Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, number 7, which confirmed what we have learned over the years from people like Rosalie Bertel and others, that there is no safe dose of radiation. And so these contaminants are in our water wherever we are near the reactors, and we're certainly exposed to them here in Ontario, and you are where you are because you've got reactors. And most of the areas around the Great Lakes do have those contaminants. Also, the mining and milling of uranium, and uranium ore is what is the fuel for nuclear reactors. The mining and milling produces large volumes of long-lived radioactive tailings, and it's serious health and environmental problems because it's poisoning our air and water as well. And there are huge tailings deposits of radioactive dust and gas constantly being dispersed into the atmosphere. Radioactive radium, plutonium, polonium, and lead are being discharged into our waters and threats to contaminate groundwaters. Plutonium is, it can be discharged. Plutonium is a result of nuclear reactors, the fission product. And the problem with it is that our spent fuel rods are very problematic in terms of the plutonium that they're produced because they can be, it's weapons-grade plutonium. So we are very concerned about the whole nuclear fuel chain and the link to nuclear weapons. I'm not sure if people in the United States are aware of the fact that the India and Pakistan nuclear bombs were developed with Canadian technology because they had CANDU reactors, and the spent fuel, which is plutonium, was used to make those bombs. So those are very important connections.
And yeah,
those are chemicals. Those are carcinogens. And we know the links to cancer, birth defects, and other diseases that are related to all these radioactive materials.
Let's just reiterate something right now that I find very important in your words. This matter of these are all, when you're describing these pollutants and the damages caused to the health of the people by exposure, you're not talking about the releases from an accident or from some catastrophe like the what happened in Fukushima. You are talking about the day-in, day-out normal operations of these facilities that have been, you know, placed amongst us, right?
Yeah, we talk about routine emissions. Routine emissions in the the daily operation of many of these reactors and all the uranium mining issues. That's routine emissions, and it's the whole it's right through the whole nuclear fuel chain. It's not just the reactors themselves. It's mining and milling and reactors production, the whole sort of process, the high-level wastes that are produced. Nobody knows really what to do with them.
Yes.
So what we need to do is make sure that people understand all of this, because this has to lead to the action to stop the nuclear power development that some of our governments want to do. What is very important about the Fukushima accident is that a number of European countries now, and including some that already have decided not to have nuclear reactors beforehand, they decided not to go nuclear. Germany is one, Switzerland is another, Spain is another, and a lot of the European countries in the north decided many years ago that they didn't want it. So it's there's a whole understanding now of the dangers of nuclear power, and that has to be a source of information that we can use to make sure that we don't allow any more nuclear reactors to be built. And that also applies to the refurbishment of the old ones. That really needs to be our mandate and our work. There's a big cover-up that goes on, the nuclear industry, the International Atomic Energy Agency, our governments. They've covered up a lot of information, and in fact, a lot of the science is denied, and I'm not sure if people who are listeners to your program are aware of the work of Dr. Rudy Nussbaum. He's a professor emeritus of physics and environmental studies at Portland State University, and he wrote an article a couple of years ago, Manipulating Public Health Research, the Nuclear and Radiation Health Establishments, within the International Journal of Occupational and Environmental Health. And he wrote that industry, government, and the military have systematically suppressed or manipulated epidemiological research showing detrimental effects on human health from accidental or occupational exposures to ionizing radiation. This leads to conflict of interest, compromised integrity among scientists in the radiation health establishment. It stifles dissemination of unwelcome findings and endangers public health. And the key words to that article are radiation health effects, research censorship, conflicts of interest, scientific whistleblowers, Chernobyl, and Three Mile Island. And no doubt now, if this article, this was in 2007, if it would be written today, they would add Fukushima and Japan, because there's been this attempt at the cover-up there. And we know that what they do is say that the language of everything is safe and allowable, and you're perfectly being taken care of, which reminds me of after Three Mile Island, after that happened, something took place. It was a workshop which was reported in Mother Jones at that time, and the workshop, the editor of and a founding member of Mother Jones, managed to slip into a workshop held by the nuclear industry with public relations industries to teach CEOs and public relations people from all the different dangerous technologies how to speak to the public. So you'll see now that there's a mantra that gets repeated after every accident. One is, there's been a serious accident, there was a major spill, but we are in the process of cleaning it up, and the public was never in danger. So we're taking care of you. So the message is, go back to sleep, everybody.
Right.
And that's been a mantra. I remember with the Exxon Valdez, that's what they were saying at the beginning. And after every major accident, the message is, we're taking care of you. Don't worry about it. So this is the way they handle it. But it's really very important that people educate themselves about the impacts of ionizing radiation. The problems are very, very well known, And I think you want to know about a little bit about cancer and
what
the relationship.
Just to backtrack up just a bit here, what is the name and a spelling of the name of the scientist that you mentioned who'd written that paper about this, you know, this misleading of the public?
The article is called Manipulating Public Health Research.
Okay.
The Nuclear and Radiation Health Establishments. And his name is Rudy, R-U-D-I, H. Nussbaum, N-U-S-S-B-A-U-M.
Okay.
P-H-D. And
it'd be good if people could track that down and read that.
Sounds very good. International Journal of Occupational Environmental Health, 2007, 13:328-330. So it's pages.
Okay.
328 and 330. It's really important because that cover-up is what keeps things from going. But we also know that there's a lot of politics. There's a lot of politics around nuclear issues. The World Health Organization is the most prestigious public health institute in the world, right?
Right.
And it's bound by a 1959 agreement within WHO to refrain from conducting or publishing any radiation health assessments without the approval made by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, this agency, in addition to monitoring nuclear weapons, has a mandate to promote nuclear power.
Hmm.
Now, what a contradiction, right?
Exactly.
But this fits in with the many misleading press releases and reports issued by these agencies downplaying the legacy of diseases left, for example, by Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. And there were other studies subsequently done by Rosalie Bertel and others, and now there was one that Dr. Jeanette Sherman co-authored and edited with a group of Russian scientists on the real findings of Chernobyl. But the others from the World Health Organization and the International Atomic Energy Agency minimize these diseases. And this, we see now the same kind of thing is happening post-Fukushima. And we had a headline here saying that radiation in Ontario is higher since the Japan crisis. And then with colon, no risk to health. Now, if we understand, according to BEIR7, the biological effects of ionizing light radiation number 7 from the National Academy of Sciences, there is no safe dose of radiation. The tiniest amounts can cause cancer and birth defects and a whole lot of other things. If we understand that, then we can't accept that there's no risk, even though the radiation is higher. So in this article, the energy minister here in Ontario, said that radiation levels have gone up slightly, but he didn't have specific details on whether the increases were found in water, air, or food. Now, they're monitoring, and we know that in the United States you've had a lot of monitoring because we have reports of, you know, it's coming both on the East Coast and the West Coast. But he keeps maintaining it's not something that Ontario residents need to be concerned about either. And then the agriculture minister said there was no need to worry as milk sold in Ontario is sterilized and pasteurized.
Well, he doesn't get it, does he?
There is such ignorance, and they make these statements, but that's why we have to do our work and understand the implications of ionizing the radiation. And we have to quote BEIR 7 and quote the National Academy of Sciences and quote IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer. There are carcinogens that cause cancer. There are mutagens that cause mutations. There are teratogens that cause harm to the developing fetus. We need to know that. We need to say it. We have to quote it. We have to have our references, and they're very, very clear now. The politics of nuclear power are really what drives the whole thing, and you know that there's a revolving door both in your country and in mine where the people who have been in the nuclear industry go into government or vice versa, or they work in relationship, or your country has lobbyists that are, you know, very tied into the industry.
It's horrible.
But we know that, you know, so that's our job. I say to my students all the time, because I teach about environmental and ecosystem health, and my students are a lot of health professionals who've never had any of this stuff before because they're learning how to treat people. Many of them are physicians, nurses, pharmacists, dentists, They're getting a degree in education because they're going to teach in their professions, and some of them are already teaching. But they've never had any of this kind of information about learning about what's actually causing it in the way that we talk about. They're learning.
This must be very eye-opening to them.
It is. It is. I just wanted to mention that also in terms of this management of public perceptions, there's a Dr. Robert Jacobs of the Hiroshima Peace Institute in Japan, and he said of Fukushima that in these institutions, managing public opinion is as serious an operation as managing the crisis itself. What we have here in Fukushima is four reactors that are still emitting significant amounts of radiation into the environment. So this is not a situation that's been brought under control because we still have leakage. So to continue telling people that the leak will cause higher, to tell them that this is a leak and to tell them about the leak is going to cause higher levels of distress. And it's going to reflect that neither TEPCO, that's the Japanese nuclear company, nor the government is in control of the situation. So it's easier to reduce the amount of information the public has so you can control the situation, at least from the point of view of public opinion, and keep people from panicking. Like, that's their message. We don't want people to be panicked instead of telling them the truth. And that's what's
Which
been
is
happening.
Wrong.
Yeah. So, but that's what we have to dig up, and anybody who's following what's been going on since Fukushima, and you have NIRS in the United States, you have a number of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. They put out terrific stuff, and other groups as well. There's a lot of good information out there now, and it may not be in the media every day, but every now and again there's an article that slips through. Not nearly enough, but immediately after the accident, it was in the media all the time. But it's subsided now, and of course they're trying to minimize it. But we have a lot of emails that are saying that the heads of the nuclear industry and of the governments in Japan are very serious about really looking at the other solutions to the energy problems. And Japan has been way ahead in solar energy for years and years. I mean, I've been following these issues, and they were doing wonderful things years ago. And when you get nuclear power going in there, it just takes away the money from the right things that we want to do.
Right.
So that's really important to understand.
Money
going into nuclear, the billions going into nuclear are preventing the solutions, the energy efficiency, conservation, renewables, et cetera, that really have to be done.
Yeah, the science has become well established. As you know, we've reached the point here where, you know, in this interview and in amongst the scientists, it is well established that the normal daily releases of nuclear power facilities, let alone these accidental catastrophes, that the normal daily routine releases of the nuclear power facilities impose cancer risk.
Absolutely.
It's well established that there is a cancer outcome that results from exposure to the normal daily releases of the nuclear power facilities. Tell us about tritium and breast cancer.
Yep, that's right. And many, many scientists have written about this. I have here with me a paper from NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resources. I'm going to give you that website because it's so important.
Okay.
It's www.nirs.org/radiation/radchart, and then HTM. And this is such an amazing compilation of the percent increases in cancer incidence, cancer mortality, and other health effects of human exposure to ionizing radiation. And there's a
Could you give that one more time, that URL one more time?
The title?
Yeah.
Percentage increase?
No. Start right over at, you know, the URL, you know, the www.
www.nirs.org/radiation/radchart, all one word, .htm.
Okay.
So it's just an amazing list of what they've done. They've compiled this legend for percent into increase in cancer incidence, cancer mortality, and other health effects of human exposure to ionizing radiation. And there's a 1,500% increase in the incidence of testicular and ovarian cancer in children of the Navajo Reserve and uranium mining area, a 500% increase in bone cancer in children affected by uranium, 250% increase in leukemia all ages in the Navajo population, 200% increase in each of the following non-cancer effects: miscarriage, infant death, congenital defects, genetic abnormalities, and learning disorders. And there's a whole study, the Navajo residents living near uranium facilities compared to Navajo residents in non-uranium areas, etc. The study is here. It's listed.
I got to see that. That's very important.
This whole document, 400% increase in leukemia incidence in the population living downwind of the Pilgrim nuclear power reactor in Massachusetts in the first 5 years after fuel was known to have leaked excess radioactivity, and the study is quoted here. 300 to 400% increase in lung cancer in the general population within the plume of the Three Mile Island accidental releases. 600 to 700 increase in leukemia in the general population within the plume of Three Mile Island accident. The disease in population upwind, out of the radiation plume, compared to the disease in the population downwind in the pollution plume. And this is from Stephen Wing, Richardson, and all. A reevaluation of cancer incidence near the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant. The collision of evidence and assumptions. It was published in Environmental Health Perspectives.
Yeah, it's so good that they're starting to quantify.
On and on it goes. All
these
different. I won't read them all, but it's Chernobyl information in Belarus, and it's in England, the workers at Sellafield and the impact on their children, the cancers in their children, the leukemias, and so on, and also in New England, the children of nuclear workers, and so on. It just goes on and on, which is heartbreaking, because so much of this could be prevented. And we really need to make this information known. And this list was compiled, actually, by Cindy Folkers and Mary Olson. Actually, it was in 98 from NIRS. A partial list of non-cancer health effects are also important because they're related to exposures to radiation. That's Down syndrome, and we have an excess of Down syndrome near our nuclear reactors here in Canada, the CANDU reactors, hydrocephaly, microhydrocephaly, cleft lip and palate, epilepsy, kidney and liver damage, thyroid disease, low birth weight, increased infant mortality, increased stillbirth, genetic mutations, chromosomal aberrations, spinal defects, and congenital malformations. So this is a very important list, and we have this kind of research available to us through these wonderful organizations, and we need to get this information out there. So when somebody says, oh, it's going to be safe, we can say, look at the history. You can't tell me that it's going
yes.
to be safe, and there's no safe dose.
So you've led right into my next question here. This matter of quantifying the risk, the magnitude of the cancer risk for any particular amount of exposure. It seems to me that there's enough science now. See, there's always a point where something further can be done. The US EPA is in the process of producing a dioxin reassessment, and it's all about how much cancer does dioxin cause based upon how much exposure. You know, how much exposure causes how much cancer. They're struggling with this because of what we've been talking about, this matter of the corporations that have an interest, in this case the food corporations and the agriculture corporations and Dow and Monsanto, because they have cleanup problems. They are obstacles to the finalization of this process by EPA. But the truth of it is there should be an assessment of the cancer risk, a quantitative assessment of the cancer risk of the nuclear power facilities, the normal daily average operations of those facilities. There's plenty of science there that could be used to create such a, you know, further step in the understanding and the public knowledge of what is involved with doing nuclear power. And I do not, as far as I know, there's no governmental entity that is engaged in producing a cancer risk assessment for the nuclear power, normal everyday emissions from the nuclear facilities.
Well, I think that there is. I do think that a lot of that has been done in terms of epidemiological studies.
Well, yes, the science is done, but I'm saying no government entity has pulled this together and produced a risk assessment to then start saying, okay, well, this can, you know, are we going to accept this much risk, or is it, you know, because see, in the U.S., it used to be that 1 in a million was the acceptable number amount of risk from any particular facility, and it's
right.
clear that the risk is far more than 1 in a million from any one of these
oh.
nuclear facilities.
Sure, for sure. Well, then that if your government and our government, they aren't doing this stuff. We do have statistics, and you have statistics
exactly.
too from cancer societies and so on, but nobody pulls it together in a way that says we've got to stop it. You know, look
exactly.
at the figures. We've got
and
to
the
stop.
The scientists, the science is there. They're cheating us of the
yeah.
right result of the science. See, this is the way it is with dioxin. With the dioxin from the incinerators and the trash burning and the metal smelting, these various
yeah.
sources, and the house fires and the car fires, the various
yeah.
sources, and yet EPA has produced a cancer risk assessment for the dioxins. They produced it way back in 2003, and yet
right.
here we are nearly 10 years later, and they are totally stalemated by the corporations. And
so,
I'm thinking the same thing about the nuclear power, and
so
I bet you the government will not take this step to pull together the epidemiology on the nuclear emissions and the exposures and the cancer. They're not doing that to take the step that they should be taking to establish a safe level and then say, well, it's not safe. It's way beyond safe. This has to end.
There is no safe level of radiation.
No safe level.
Period. There
that's
is
the
no
point.
Safe level.
And see, that's
is
the way it is with dioxin, too.
Risk, well, no, that's true, too. Dioxin, it's the same, I don't know if you're familiar with Sandra Steingraber's work.
Somewhat.
And, Sandra Steingraber, she doesn't talk about nuclear issues, but she talks about hormone disruption. She's a brilliant writer. She wrote a book called Living Downstream, and she just reissued it 10 years later. She then wrote a book called Having Faith, an Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood, which is about the development of the fetus and the fact that the first trimester of pregnancy is when all of the organs and many of the systems are being laid down, and exposures, the tiniest exposures during those what we call periods of windows of vulnerability when the cells are rapidly multiplying and everything's being laid down. No safe dose, because the tiniest amounts can cause a whole lot of disturbances in those very early times. And she uses the examples of DES, of Minamata disease, of thalidomide, different things that took place when the mother was pregnant, during different stages of pregnancy, German measles, you know, blindness. I mean, all these different results happen because of exposure to whatever it was in that very early stage of pregnancy. I use a chapter in her book, Having Faith in Ecologists of Motherhood. She doesn't talk about nuclear stuff, but the implications are there. But there are other people who do, and
right.
I have some information about the nuclear stuff. But a baby girl's eggs are all formed in that first trimester of pregnancy. Those are all the eggs she's ever going to have, whereas a boy begins to manufacture sperm in puberty. But for a little girl, those are all the eggs she's ever going to have, and then she begins to menstruate, and she drops an egg every month. But those eggs can be damaged in that early stage of pregnancy. You're always going to have pregnant women around. And the other side is, the other part of that is rapidly multiplying cells, young girls developing breasts as well. So those are windows of vulnerability. Rapidly multiplying cells, there is no safe dose of any of these chemicals. Whereas risk assessment is based on a healthy male working in a factory.
Exactly.
And what it will take to make him sick.
Exactly.
So we have to stop all this stuff. Now, we have major corporations who deny this, and we know that there are lies galore, and it's all about money and business, but it's our job to make this information known, and that's why I think education is so important. That's why I make films about these issues, to help people to have tools to expand their knowledge and take that to other people. And then people, once they open the door to these things, they are much more able to take action, to join groups, to become involved. And a lot of people are involved. I mean, there are so many good groups now working on so many of these issues. Because we know, you know, when I've worked on a film called Exposure, Environmental Links to Breast Cancer. And we have Rosalie Bertel explaining about radiation and even mammography, et cetera. But what we know from all of them is that there is a relationship. And there was a study that was done by Richard Clapp, Genevieve Howe, Molly Jacobs, and it was the Boston University School of Public Health and Environmental Health Initiative at U, Massachusetts, in Lowell. They did a study that looked at the various cancers and chemicals and radiation that they're related to, and it's the state of science by cancer, and they looked at the relationship of ionizing radiation to bladder, to bone, to brain, to breast, colon, leukemia, liver, lung, multiple myeloma, nasopharynx, stomach, and thyroid cancers. Like, the studies are there. It's known. You don't have to go very far to find that information. And we know that we have to make it public. I mean, that is our job. Our job is to make this information public so that the people are aware of it. When we talk about nuclear power expansion, most people will talk about the energy needs, which is very important because we know about the energy issues. We know about the fact that if we really put the billions into energy efficiency, conservation, renewables, et cetera, and a whole range of things, it will make a huge difference. I mean, I live on the 10th floor of an apartment building, and I look out at the city of Toronto, and I envision solar panels on the roofs of all of these buildings and think that's where the money should be going instead of nuclear. You know, the whole notion of the fact that we know what we have to do, and many cities are beginning to do it. A lot is happening in the cities. A lot more is happening in the cities than is happening with our national governments, I have to say, because they are totally in the hands of the nuclear industry, is what we know. But we know also that the issues are about health. And when you talk about health, it takes another facet. We talk about the energy stuff, it's important. We talk about the costs, very important. We talk about high-level nuclear waste, very important. We talk about the weapons from plutonium, from spent fuel from reactors, very important. But we have to talk about these routine emissions. You call them normal emissions. I say they're very abnormal. They're routine emissions.
Routine is a better word.
You know, it's so abnormal. And the whole situation really is so sick that we have to really educate our colleagues, all our friends, all our public, to make sure that we do the right thing, because it's been going on for so very, very long. And we know that these exposures are getting worse. The statistics for cancer are getting worse all the time. And this is not the only thing. You know, there are many other contaminants that are also causing cancer that we know of. And they all mix together, and what we know, tritium combines with a whole lot of other things in our drinking water. And the problems are that there is no safe dose.
So, and there's too many chemicals. When you have no safe dose for so many chemicals,
exactly.
It's obvious why everybody has cancer. It's obvious why so many people are getting cancer. It's just horrible.
It's heartbreaking.
We're swimming in a sea of carcinogens, and then people are wondering why the cancer rates are going up.
Well, this is our work, you know. I mean, we know. I mean, this the whole future of our world is going to, you know, be affected, because all these birth defects and so on that are happening are an indication of what will happen more in the future as this stuff happens continually. And this Fukushima accident is really something that we have to continue to pay a lot of attention to, because the impacts are being felt now all over the world. And I heard on the radio saying, oh, we don't have to worry about it so much now because it's going into the ocean. Well, you know, the ocean is where so much food of the world is derived. The ocean has life in it, equivalent to what, and more. There's much more of water mass on the planet, if you look at the maps, than there is, you know, land. And this radiation is going throughout that whole food system, the fish, all the other live things in the oceans are being affected, and who knows what those impacts are going to result in. We know a lot about certain carcinogens, tritium and carbon-14 and so on and so forth. We certainly know that those are fantastic contaminants contaminants that affect the protein precursors that are making up the chromosomal strands in the DNA, and damaging the DNA and the mutations. I mean, you know, these results, these cancers, miscarriages, birth defects, sterility, hypothyroidism, etc. You know, this is not just to our generation now, but it's our offspring and theirs. So, you know, how do we help people to understand that these health impacts need to be made public? That's our job, because I think that many, many people, when they are touched with these stories and these studies and these results and these statistics, will open up their minds to getting in touch with the people that make these decisions. And,
well,
you know, you
give us, tell us about the Darlington reactor rebuild. This is a perfect example of what's going on right now. This science exists in the world. The government's doing one thing. You and your associates, these activists, these scientists, these environmental leaders, you are looking at this in a different way and putting your knowledge before the government. So what is happening with this Darlington power facility rebuild?
Well, we have a number of reactors at Pickering and Darlington on Lake Ontario, which are eight reactors at each site, and they are in operation, or they have been in various stages of shutdown over the years. They have had various spills and accidents, but they have these routine emissions. So a number of years ago, there was an ACES report in 1994, the Advisory Council on Environmental Standards, which recommended a major reduction in the amount of allowable tritium going into the drinking water of Lake Ontario. Now, Lake Ontario is Toronto, and millions of people who derive their drinking water from Lake Ontario, and Lake Ontario goes down into the St. Lawrence, etc. So lots of people are exposed. So the government of the time was our New Democratic Party, and they were threatened that they would shut down the whole economy of the province if they dared to take the recommendations of the ACES report into serious action. So they didn't, and I'll never forgive them, because they're the people that we most can rely on, because the other two parties, the Liberals and the Conservatives, are very pro-nuclear, and they're the NDP, the New Democratic Party, are not. They're our semi-socialist party with their... They're not, they didn't do the right thing, and we heard that it was pressure from the nuclear industry and the other parties that were in control. People were really quite shocked and amazed that the NDP even got in, but they were so disgusted with the other governments that that's why they were voted in, almost as a protest vote. Then we had recently our Toronto Cancer Prevention Coalition, which I am on, a few years ago, brought to the attention of the Board of Health, the Medical Officer of Health, to put pressure on the government to initiate hearings again in light of the fact that the government was proposing to not only refurbish the old reactors, which are supposed to come to the end of their natural end in a few years, rather than refurbishing them. The whole notion was to re-examine the ACES report and call for a reduction in the allowable amount of radionuclides into the drinking water of Ontario people. And our work resulted in the Medical Officer of Health of Toronto putting a letter into the Minister of the Environment to request that the standards be changed. Standards are 7,000 becquerels per liter allowable in our water, whereas there are other jurisdictions that have much lower standards, much lower amounts allowed. California has a voluntary emission allowance, which is 15, and there are other countries that have 15 and 20 becquerels per liter, etc. Anyway, the recommendations from what happened with ACES was that there be 100 becquerels, lower it to 100 becquerels per liter, and then to 20 becquerels per liter. Then, when the Ministry of the Environment, I'm giving you a lot of detailed stuff, but basically it went through the Ministry of the Environment this time, where they put it under the Ontario Drinking Water Advisory Council. We had hearings and we did deputations. My deputations have always focused on the health of women and children, because it relates so much to the rapidly multiplying cells and the windows of vulnerability that I discussed earlier, and that represents not only the people themselves now, but future generations. So The recommendations from the Ontario Drinking Water Advisory Council were like the ACES report. First, go down to 100 becquerels per liter. Remember, it's from 7,000, which is allowable. We don't usually have that many becquerels per liter going into the water, but nevertheless, that's the allowable amount, which is basically permission to pollute, right? When you have a risk assessment finding and they come out with a recommendation and it's higher than what you can, what you should be having, it's basically permission to pollute. So the recommendation from this particular Ontario Drinking Water Advisory Council was, again, bring it down to 100 and then to 20. Many of us, our Canadian Environmental Law Association, many of our environmental organizations, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, many of us wanted it to be more stringent. Many recommended that over time it should be reduced to 10 becquerels, 5 becquerels, and our Women's Healthy Environments Network and the Canadian Environmental Law Association said zero discharge because of the reasons that I've mentioned to you. So the question has to be, what is acceptable when it comes to health? You know, what standards of risk assessment are safe enough when it comes to those windows of vulnerability?
So there's nothing. There's no safe level.
No. And we need to recognize that, both in your country, in my country, in all of the countries, that we cannot allow any of this stuff to escape. And there's no way to prevent it from escaping because these are not closed systems. So our work really is in education of the public, who can then put pressure, like we did. This is a policy thing. We took this to through our Toronto Cancer Prevention Coalition with Toronto Public Health, with our Toronto Medical Officer of Health, going to the Ministry of the Environment of Ontario. Like, we did it through a policy procedure, you see, because
yep.
we knew we had to deal with more than just talking about it. We
right.
had to make policies that are going to make recommendations. Now, we have not heard what the ministry is going to do about these Ontario Drinking Water Advisory Council recommendations. We have not heard, and we understand from what we're hearing is that they're going to look at other recommendations, like their recommendations from the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, which is also, it's supposed to be our watchdog, but of course, many of these people, it's a revolving door, you know, they
right,
go into
exactly.
the industry, the scientists, and blah, blah, blah. And so they come out with different studies. They look at different things, and they say that there's that this much is allowable and that much is allowable. They don't pay attention to the, you know, National Academy of Sciences studies and all the others that we're talking about because it suits their needs not to. So
exactly.
we understand now that they're not going to be so clear about what they do in a way that we would like them to be clear when they come out with their recommendations because they want to build more reactors.
Right.
Very politically fraught. So this is something that is of great concern to us because we know that we can't allow, for so many reasons, we can't
right.
allow this. But that's our work, and we have campaigns, and we have organizations, and we have postcards that we have people sending in. The Ontario Clean Air Alliance has postcards going to both leaders of the Liberal and Conservative parties on this, on these issues. Jack Gibbons, who's an economist, has done a really very stringent economic analysis of the money going into nuclear power and where it should be going otherwise. It's like there's no question that we have all the information, but I think we're at a very good time in history. It's not good for the world because of Fukushima. But in our educational work, there's a book called Naming the Moment, When You Need to Act. And I think that this Fukushima issue brings us to a point now where the world is much readier to listen to these issues, much readier to pay attention because it's been in the news, and we know that the solutions are there, and there are many countries that are going in that direction. So because there is so much to be done towards changing things, we can take that advantage of the time and go forward using this moment, naming this particular moment in time to change things on the nuclear issue. We have
yep.
lots of work to do to make that happen, but there's a readiness now, I think, that we didn't have since Chernobyl when everybody was talking about nuclear power in a way that we, you know, we didn't know what was happening, but now we know much more.
Exactly. Tell me now, it's clear from what you've said so far that the people living downstream, the people that are drinking the water that has the tritium in it, put there by the routine operations of the facilities, it's clear that they are being placed at an unacceptable level of cancer risk. Can you tell us?
And it's not just downstream. You know, water doesn't always go downstream. When you have a big lake like Lake Ontario, you have different changes in the current.
Exactly.
So we're all affected. I mean, I live in Toronto. These reactors are downstream from here, but the water is circulating.
Right.
I don't know if you you probably don't know. It kind of reminds me of the smoking stuff. You know, I can well remember when I was working in, I was living in Montreal, going to Ottawa, and I went on the bus every week to Ottawa, and the first six rows were no smoking, and the rest was smoking
right.
on the bus. You know, and the airplanes were like that, you know, smoking stuff. So at that time, there's a comedian, it's called the Canadian Royal Air Farce.
Right, I've seen that,
this was a radio program at the time, I think. And so there was this comedian who said, having a smoking section in a bus or an airplane is like having a peeing section in a swimming pool.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
You know, when you talk about how stuff is going into our air and water and so on, you don't think about it swirling around and anybody being affected by it. And so even the notion of downstream is a good way of measuring plumes and particular, you know, streams of things. But we can't ignore people in the surrounding areas who may not be that in that downstream. You know, we are all affected in some ways because the wind doesn't always blow in the same direction. But there's no question that the downstreamers, and, you know, I mean, in your country, many have written about this. Certainly with Hanford in out west, there's a whole lot of downstream literature, and many other places as
well.
In
this case, when you say downstream, you're talking downwind?
Downstream, downwind. Yeah, the downwinder. It's a downstream or downwind. You know, it's in the water.
Yeah, and so, see, this is very important to our community here. Say like here in the St. Lawrence River Valley, there are many who do get their municipal drinking water, you know, if you live in, say, the village of Morristown or the village of Messina or the city of Augsburg. They drink the tritium. But what about breathing? What about breathing the emissions or being exposed to what comes in the air? Say, there's something, pollutants?
I think the air issue is important in terms of the food. Tritium, radionuclides can be taken up by food in the soil, and they can be taken up by the fish in the water and the plants growing in the water. So we're getting it one way or another. And it's quite obvious, and there are studies done. There was a Japanese scientist years ago who was planting little flowers near the nuclear reactors or around the nuclear reactors, and when those flowers turned a certain color, that meant that they were being exposed to radioactivity. So there's no question that it's taken up by the plants, by the food, and so it is harmful, and we are all exposed to all of that stuff. The thing that I sometimes marvel at is that there's organic food being grown near nuclear reactors. I mean, it's oxymoron to me. You know, how can this be? How can you call this organic just because you're not using pesticides,
right,
but you're exposed to all these radionuclides in your soil? You know, so but this is where education, I keep harping on education. People are so ignorant. And when you have a politician like this one saying the milk is safe because it's pasteurized, what does radioactivity have to do with pasteurization? You know, it is like the ignorance of politicians, the ignorance of policy people is phenomenal.
Horrible.
And so our job is to educate them and join with groups. We can't do it alone. I work with many organizations. I'm a founding member of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility in Montreal with Gordon Edwards and Fred Nelman many years ago. I moved to Toronto 21 years this fall to be a student in my old age and do my master's and my PhD. But, you know, this stuff is so necessary to be engaged with groups, because we can't do it alone. And you have such good groups in your country. We have good groups here. We need to work with the physicians. Your Physicians for Social Responsibility in the States do wonderful work. NEARS does wonderful work. I mean, there are wonderful, wonderful people, studies, information, programs, platforms. Get the websites. Get on the campaigns. Work with the good politicians who, God knows, you have a job to do with Obama. Look what's happened to him. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
Horrible.
It sucks for him. And he's, like, these politicians, they get tied around the neck by the nuclear industry.
Exactly.
And, you know, and they're talking about clean coal. Like, what are they doing? You know, they're talking about more of the same problems that God has.
More of the same. You've done a good job. You've done a good job of bringing us to the point where we can wrap this up. Is there anything more in like a minute that you want to say about this issue, or you just want to like agree to do another interview?
I'm happy to do another interview, Don.
Perfect.
I think your work is quite exemplary, and I don't know if you get feedback from your listeners, but it would be very interesting to know at some point what people have done, and it might be a question to ask of them. What organization have you joined in your community? What influence can you have on your various elected politicians? What can you do to make these issues known? Show the Helen Caldicott film if you love this planet. You've got a lot of good films about ionizing radiation.
We need to do a whole interview about your knowledge of film, your knowledge of films that exist, and your knowledge of producing films. And I can see a whole interview on that for sure, you know.
Well, you know, when you get to be my age, these old grandmas, you know, we have a lot of experience. We've been around a long time. And
Viva wisdom.
And you know what? We work with the most wonderful people, because when you get involved in these social movements for peace and social justice and environment and anti-nuclear and safe energy and gender, race, and class, and all these power relationships, you really understand that there are such good people out there, and you want to work with them.
Well, thank you so much, Dorothy. This has been a great interview. You are very inspiring. You know, honor to Dorothy Golden Rosenberg for the life you've lived and the life you're living, and hopefully you'll live for 100 years at least.
Oh, of course. On my bicycle.
Yes. Okay. Well,
bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
This has been Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth and Environmental Revolution. Dorothy Golden Rosenberg has been sharing with us her expert knowledge of the adverse, the damages to health, the adverse health effects, I prefer to use the phrase damages to health, caused by exposure to the routine emissions from nuclear power facilities. I'm hoping the listeners have listened carefully and will do what we're encouraging them to do, follow our examples, and be the revolution. Good day.